All righty. Our speaker today is Karen Robichard. And if you don't know Karen, then you missed out on knowing Karen. She's a great lady. We've had lunch a few times over the years and always say, okay, we're going to do this sooner next time. And we don't, but we're going to soon, right?
Right.
Okay, then. So, Karen, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you. And what is better than lunch with Paulette? When I think about everything good at Otter Creek, I think about Paulette. I started coming here 10 years ago, right after my divorce, and Paulette was a warm, safe place for me. And so I just want to thank you guys, because part of today is we're talking about grief and we're talking about suffering, but also just ways that as Christians we can really support and rally around each other in a comforting way, in a healthy way. Now, here's the situation. I know that many of you are subject matter experts when it comes to grief. You are. You've been through some really heavy things. You've been through some significant losses. And so I'm hoping today isn't me prattling on telling my story, although I'm so grateful to be able to do that. I want this to be more of a conversation as we all make sense of the things that we are given. And so I love this concept of this is my story, this is my song. Because when Rod and Susan were talking just 2 weeks ago, the concept of how Christian music has really expedited a lot of my healing, and so many of the great hymns are so poignant to who we are, right? And so I'm kind of greedy, though. I need to be honest. I couldn't choose just one song because I'm selfish. So I chose the songs of Bob Dylan to kind of... for a couple reasons. One, I've loved Bob Dylan since I was in the sixth grade. I'm one of those dorky kids that didn't like New Kids on the Block. I just wanted to sit and write letters to Bob Dylan. And
I was sort of incensed, you know, in the sixth grade when I was rocking out to like a Rolling Stone, and my mom started singing along too, and I was like, what? How dare you encroach on my music? But anyway, Bob Dylan is... so important to me because he's an Enneagram 4 and he's an ENFP, and those are just fancy ways of saying, like, he really loves words and he makes sense of his feelings through telling stories. So again, that's why this class today is so important to me, because I get to make sense of some of the things that have happened to me on this journey of life, and I get to share that. So thanks for coming, and again, I hope that you will participate. This is a participatory class. And another thing, I've never talked about some of these things before, this housekeeping. So there may be a point in today's talk where I cry, and there may be a point in today's talk that you cry, but I will ask that you not pity me, because a part of this process that I've learned in my own grief and my own suffering is pity really disconnects us from each other. And I love to connect. I really want to connect, and I want to know people, and I want to facilitate a meaningful conversation that's deep. That's one of my favorite things. So again, thank you, Paulette, for giving us this platform to discuss things. So way before I had my stroke and my open heart surgery and my divorce, way before then, I had a class on death and dying. And in it, my teacher said, very beginning of class, she said, to know how to live your best life, you really need to know how to die. And I didn't know how to think about that. I mean, I was in my 20s. I loved just the profound thought of knowing how to die, like, teaches you how to live. And I want to ask you guys, do you believe that? Do you think knowing how you kind of want to process those last moments on earth, do you feel that can enrich the way that you live now? I'll give you an example. The five most beautiful days of my life. Three of them were the 3 days that my children were born, right? Mm-hmm. But the other two, this might sound odd, I was with both of my grandmothers when they passed. Mm-hmm. And it was such a poignant, precious moment. It was just me and my grandmother Clark, my mom's mom. She loved me. I was her special K way before the cereal was popular. Like, I was her special K. And so to get to be with her as she passed on to heaven was just, it was just very sweet and poignant and very meaningful to me. Likewise, with my dad's mother, there were 20 cousins singing songs right out of hymn books as she left us. And that was such a beautiful moment. And that's how I want to go. I want to, either one of those. That's exactly how I want to go praising the Lord, and I want to go surrounded by family. So that really helps me kind of back up, okay, well, how can I live today that will help me pass in that way? But tell me, do you guys have any experiences like that? Do you feel like knowing how to die helps you, encourages you on how to live? Roger.
You know, you read obituaries.
Yes.
And many obituaries will speak about how the family was by their side.
Yes.
When they, so you think that's helpful? I mean, I'm just saying.
Absolutely. I mean, I think being around people you love and being, I think that's precious, right? I think. And it also makes you want to create the kind of relationships today that will foster that, for sure. Yes. So the times, they're changing. Yes, ma'am.
To your original question about live, how to live compared to how to die. Some of my relatives took a long time to die.
Right.
And they were dying.
Yes.
And so it's not always a quick,
yes,
here's how I'm going to die. And what I saw that was just helpful to all of us and helpful to these family members was they really took an inventory of their possessions.
Right.
And the things that cluttered their lives. Mm-hmm. And these people weren't messy clutterers. I'm not saying that. They're just saying that really doesn't matter anymore. And that doesn't matter, and that doesn't matter. Or, my mom was so sweet, I won't say she was always sweet, but in this, she was sweet. Please take those records to so-and-so. Please take my yarn to so-and-so.
Yes.
I just wanted to say yes to any request. So, in the end, she had very little around her, and I want to do that for my children now.
Yes.
And I am doing that for my children and myself now. Less now and an easy transition and a gift to whoever's left with the rest.
And there's calm and there's peace in that. I love that statement because then Emily will know. Like there's no question. She knows your wishes. When there's clarity, what a gift. What a gift to everybody. Rob?
We have a very dear friend who's in the process of dying. She's been in hospice. She actually was supposed to already be gone. She didn't expect to have Christmas or Thanksgiving or any of that, but she's still here. But we've been blessed to be able to journey with her through Caring Bridge.
Yes.
You know, but what I would note is that her dying is actually a reflection of her living in her case. We've watched it. It's been the inspiration that she and her husband had provided for hundreds and hundreds of us as we journeyed with them. It's really just, it's a reflection of the life they lived. You know, she's dying like she lived, her faith. Everybody should be able to follow this journey with her because it's pretty incredible. But that's how they lived
right. For
years and years.
Raise your hand if you've ever been to a funeral or like Rob, you've walked with anybody or seen them on Caring Bridge and it was a sermon. You know, my friend Sarah, who died way too soon, I got to walk very closely with her cancer journey, and I felt like the best sermons I've ever heard were from Sarah the last day. You know, what she wrote on Caring Bridge was so poignant and was almost like a revolution in Brentwood and Nashville for how to raise kids, how to save her, and so it could very much be like this. Willing design. Yeah, I love that, Rob. And I love that we are part of a congregation that is so open about it, right? That we have Josh, who talked about behavioral health, who had a whole series on it. That we have resources in this class for people that are grief. I started coming here because of divorce care. That we are not a family that shies away from talking about the really hard things when people need them and meeting them where they are. I really feel proud and I feel honored to be a part of a group that's so open and transparent about something so mystifying as death and something so vulnerable as pain and suffering. That feels refreshing and it feels open and it feels like church, right? It's how I want a church to always be, where we can be very honest about the challenging things and have solidarity in those moments and give each other hope
peace and light. And so I think about, like, over the years, how your views have evolved on things like tears, medication, group therapy. Like, have you had any shifts in any of those? Because I grew up with parents who said dry it up as soon as they saw me cry. And then, but it stopped. They said, stop or I'll give you something to cry about. You know, and I don't know if any of you had parents like that, but so for me into adulthood, I had a lot of shame anytime I'd start crying. But now I know I flipped the script on that. And I feel like I'm being brave when I cry. And I know that sometimes those tears physiologically expedites the healing process. It's the holding it in that sometimes has caused me to self-destruct in some negative ways. So, yoga.
Excuse me. I was just going, before you leave that first subject, I was going to say that I don't think any of us know how we're going to handle dying. I don't think it's something that you can know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to be this way, because we've not experienced it, so we don't know. But I have always said, I'm not afraid of dying. Dying is something, I'm ready anytime. I'm not signing up for this afternoon, but I really am truly, I will welcome it when it comes. And so what that's done for me is to free me from worry about dying. I don't have anything, I just don't want to do that, you know. Whatever it is, you know, I have confidence that it's going to be what it's supposed to be, and that I will react, hopefully, the same way I'm reacting to it now.
I love everything about what you said. Can we all memorize that and tattoo it on our brain? I'm not afraid to die anymore either. And once you've looked death in the face and you've seen, like, okay, it's not the end of anything. I will still very much go on after this meat suit, this body that I've checked out for the last 48 years. Me as a soul and a person, this is just the world. Yes.
Well, no. Just going off what she said, we all know what our destination is already.
Right.
So what that does, that allows us to wake up in the morning and just thank God for today. Because, as she said, we have no idea when our time is coming. And it doesn't matter how healthy you stay or anything else, when he decides it's time to come home, it's time to come home. But I know where my destination is. So that makes today could be the last day. So I will live today like it is my last day. And if we can focus on that, that makes that day so good, because it could be the last one.
Now, tell me, does that change the conversations you have? Because people will tell me, since my very near-death experience, that people will say, it's too much. I'm a lot. But what they mean is they're uncomfortable with how much I've gushed, because I feel very strongly about telling you how important you are to me. You said something 2 weeks ago that's affected me every day, and you told me about your husband's death and how there wasn't as much sadness because you felt like he'd fully lived his life. And no doubt you miss him every day, but there was so much peace in that. So your words have affected me every day since you told me that. But some people will hear me give a compliment and they'll be like, too much. But I feel like I wanted to give you the flowers today. I don't want to wait till your funeral. I want to tell you what you mean to me today, because I've had this experience where I don't want to take it for granted, right?
I was talking to Laura Gall. A lot of y'all know Laura. And she was just like, I know you've lost Doug. I'm just thinking about how sad I'm going to be when my dad dies. And I just thought about that, because I said, and then later I thought, and I haven't exactly told her yet because she went on back home, but her dad has lived such a full life. He founded the Faith Family Medical Center. he is always just going out of his way to do good for people. And I thought, you know, he has, you don't feel too sad because your dad, and they've traveled all over the world, taking their family to, you know, Israel all together. I mean, it's just been, they've had such impactful lives, and I'm sure everybody in here is the same way. We've had such great blessings. Right. We can't exactly feel too sorry for ourselves.
And then I want to build that to what Rob said, as far as, you know, when you have that depth of feeling, and you know, like, there's just a confidence, right? And it is, it's so impactful and empowering to other people around you. Yes, sir.
Yeah. So my wife died in 07.
Yes.
And she died suddenly. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I said from the get-go about that, even though I didn't mean it 100%, is that I'm going to, rather than focusing on we were married 39 and a half years.
Right.
And we thought we had another 20, 25 years together. And she died suddenly. And so I almost from, I know that first week, you know, focus on being grateful for the time you had.
Yes.
Rather than obsessing about the time you didn't have. And I went to grief classes and watched videos and sat around with other people who had similar experiences in the grief stuff. And all of that was good. And I've read books on grieving. Bernie Arnold and Terry Spencer gave me the same book.
Yeah.
So I actually read that one. And what I learned through that is that you can do all this stuff, all this proactive stuff, but there's a component of time that you can't rush. Time just takes time. And I had a friend from high school that she had lost her husband 5 years before my wife died. Mm-hmm. And she told me, I saw her one summer, and she was giving me advice that I wasn't asking for. And but what she said was, I took it in, and I believe she's right for me too. She says, Steve, it takes about 5 years to process the death of losing a spouse, and that was helpful. And then another thing I have for several decades now, I write down nearly every day 5 things I'm grateful for.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's not the 5 most important things, it is the first 5 things that come into my head.
Yeah.
And
well, thank you. Thanks. I so appreciate that. You're stepping on my punchlines now, Steve. Yeah, gratitude is a huge part of the healing journey for a lot of people. So thank you. Yeah, thanks so much for telling that about your wife, and definitely the guidelines.
The whole community of faith was so surprised at her death. It was so sudden. Just so.
Yeah.
And Steve's, go ahead.
Yeah, we were at, you know, Dan had a bunch of us over, and we sang with Doug one afternoon, and that was a powerful memory and positive memory in my mind.
Awesome.
Let me add just one more thing, and it's a little bit lighter. I'm a person who likes to plan ahead.
Yes.
And I found on the sale table in the bookstore a book called My Last Wishes. And it just reminded you of so many things that it would be good if you do it ahead of time. And so I worked on that. So then I decided I would just ask people that I would like to participate when I die to say something or do something and that sort of thing. And then I have some good friends, and I was with them several times when I told that story. And the husband looked at me and he said, "Sue, you know, I'm getting the feeling that you want us to rehearse this."
That's funny. And there is, Steve hit it, you hit it, Rob hit it. There is a preemptive grieving. There is this, when you know someone's sick for a long time, and there is this preemptive grief when you know something's ahead of you. And I see so many of my friends are doing it right now because their kids are going off to college, and there's a preemptive grief with that. That's another pain. And sometimes you start going through the five stages of grief, and everything that I'm saying today is just recycled from my amazing yoga teacher, from Billy Edgeworth, who is also my sister, and also from Elizabeth Kubler Ross. And I read a lot, and I have some books if you want to borrow any. But I, you know, really listening to and studying this topic, people talk differently about the stages of grief. And I'm going to talk about them as they applied to me the day that I had my stroke. Right, so I have, just to give you a context, I was 33 years old. I'd just gone on a run. I had a 2-week-old and a 16-month-old. And I took them both to the doctor with their father to get their, Ben had to have his infant appointment. And Jack was a wild beast of a toddler, and he had to get a couple shots that day. So we took the little ones in, and Jack, like I said, wasn't the easiest of babies. You know, I don't know if any of yours kind of baited and switched you, like we fell in love with him. And then he kind of turned like Old Yeller, you know. He was too cute to put down, but challenging. So the baby, Sean was holding our 2-week-old, their dad, and then Jack took off down the hall because that's what Jack did. He was not going to do what he was supposed to. So I took Jack up and I picked him up, and he's a very large, he's now 6'5", so he was even a large toddler. I threw my clot when I picked him up. And so what happens is God designs us so beautifully that so we won't hemorrhage during childbirth, we clot really easily after we have babies. And so I was really dehydrated from my run, and I threw a clot and went straight to my brain. And so I dropped Jack, and everyone around me started panicking. But this is when the denial for me started, because I was like, I'm just a little stressed. I thought I had Bell's palsy. I was working on a research project that was not going well. I had had a pretty big disagreement with my husband, and I had these two babies that none of whom were that easy, you know. So there were some challenging things going on in my life. So I just thought, I've got Bell's palsy, you know, I'm stressed out, I'll be fine. And so that magical thinking that people talk about hit me pretty quickly. Like, so I was in denial. I just thought, if I go back home, it's kind of like your computer, when you turn it on or off your phone, it'll work, you know. And if I can just go home and get it like a reset on this day, I'm going to be okay. But no, that didn't happen. And so I was really lucky because I was in the doctor's office, so I got to go to Centennial pretty quickly, and I have a lot of family. I have a very large tribal family. And so my sister Kendra came right away and picked up my boys. The lights and the ambulance started taking me during my stroke to Centennial. And that's when I skipped anger, and I went straight to bargaining. And I was like, Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, please let me make it to kindergarten. Like, please let me sing like this little line of mine a few times to Jack and Ben. Like, please help me with my sons. Like, make it. I just, for whatever reason I just had to make it to the end of kindergarten. So like in the ambulance, I remember thinking that. So think about yourself, like in your own suffering and your own grief. What did the five, what did those five stages look like? Because they're not always linear, right? And sometimes you take 3 steps forward, and then you might bounce back to bargaining again. I did go through depression after my stroke because they found out I had the stroke because I had a very large hole in my heart, about the size of a silver dollar. And so a lot of times they can do like a minimally invasive thing, but because I guess I'm a little extra, my hole's really large and in an odd spot. And so I had to have open heart surgery. So I was like, then I went back to bargaining again, just denial. No, I have these two babies. You know, I'm
No, you know, like, it was almost like I was angry at, I don't think I was angry at God yet, but I was definitely angry at the system and at this thing, because I think I thought because I had been healthy my whole life, and but I think the Lord needed to teach me now, you know, needed to humble me a bit, you know, and really help me understand that my value was never going to be in fitness or my roles. I think that was really important for me to learn that I shouldn't just sing, "You're my rock, you're my fortress, you're my deliverer," and him do I, you know, like I can't just sing that. Like, I've got to live that out. And I do think it was a gift that I was able to kind of drop all those roles. So anyway, I do think depression hit me a little bit, and I had friends that kind of rallied around me and helped me during that time. And then acceptance, as you guys know, that have suffered, it doesn't always mean like, yes, like acceptance, it just is mean like, okay, this is my new reality. You know, my new reality for a while was I couldn't stand up. I couldn't walk across the room. And so I'd gotten so much of my identity over the years through sports. You know, when you were one of the same gender, you had to get labeled something, and I was the sporty one. And so I had to drop that right away when I couldn't walk, let alone run or be active or be very competitive at all. So here's what I want to take away. There were some beautiful ways that people showed up as Jesus in skin in that moment. And one was Dr. Jim Arnett. Do you know this man? Mm-hmm. He's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Get to know him. So Dr. Jim Arnett was an elder at Bremen Hills Church of Christ, where I attended at that time. And he was one of the first on the scene. And he said the thing that I needed somebody to say, which was, if Karen dies today, Lord, accept her. Because I needed someone to say that. Because I knew in my bones, the way everybody was looking at me, my face, half of it was drooping. You know, like, I knew that it was serious, and I knew I might die. And is that no one knew what was happening with me. And so the very real fear was, what if I have a next one? What happens when I have my next stroke? You know, I very much could be, things could be very different. And so the fact that he just was, I would just like to encourage each of you, if you're in the moment when someone is dying, to say it, to boldly and courageously, just like, you know, Joshua, you know, be bold and courageous and say the thing. Say the thing that you've always wanted to say, you know, because I think people need to hear it. And so in that prayer, it was just really super sweet that he mentioned heaven, and he mentioned, you know, my family here on earth being okay with me as I consent. So that was a gift. I had to let go. I had to let go of the reality of I had been this coach and I just had this baby, and so the juxtaposition of bringing this baby in the world and then almost dying was really, and finishing, you know, like it was a very strange foil. To have a new life and to have these little bitty babies, but to not really be able to take care of them. And so I think that was one of the gifts too, is like having people serve me. I'm a prideful woman, full of, you know, and so like to be able to be humbled in that season. And, you know, my sister took my infant for a month to keep it. My in-laws were amazing, and they kept Wild Jack for, you know, for a while. So it was really great to have help and to have people serve me. And there was one day, one of my best friends even said, hey, Karen, what can I do? And I said, you know, we're okay, which was a lie. We were not okay. We were anything but okay. And she said, Karen, I really love her. I wish she was here. She said, quit denying me the jewel in my crown that I'll get. And so some of you need to hear that again. Quit denying those around you the jewel in their crown that they'll get from serving you. Because in the middle of grief, like, we're built that way. It's the way God made us, to serve and love and pour into other people. And so let people do it. It's so humbling. It's so humbling to have people, you know, I'd have people come over and cook for me and clean. It was so embarrassing. Clean my toilets, you know. But those were, God's army showed up for me. The Lord's army showed up mightily for me in a wide variety of ways. And so I want you to think of what were some ways that during your suffering and your grief that you saw Jesus. You saw Jesus in skin. Because I saw him all over the place with people. One of my friends, she sent me a psalm every day. And I needed those because I was just staying in bed listening to Dust and Wind on repeat. And so I needed those prayers to that psalm, and I needed like hope and light and people that were comfortable being uncomfortable with me. I think sometimes, you know, and Fred said to us the other day, what's the right thing to say? You know what, I don't think it's too much pressure, Fred. I think we just show up and hold a hand. Because there's nothing you can say. You know, in 2007, when your wife died, Steve, there wasn't much of anything anybody could say. Just good memories of her. You know, there's such a disorienting pain sometimes. But I think just letting other people show up and pour into us, such a gift, right? And so have you ever had an experience where someone, besides meals and the obvious, has anyone ever done anything that you thought, I'm going to do that?
Say that again.
Like when suffering happens, or like, was there anything, Steve, that anybody did for you after the loss of your wife that you were like, that was amazing? That really expedited healing or made me feel better?
I just felt a lot of people care. Yeah. I know one thing I was, when you were talking, I was talking about two things that's not connected with that, but I remember about, you know, 2 or 3 months after Sue died, I was walking in Brentwood over there around where Puffy Muffin is now. And so an old fellow parent at Brentwood Academy, ran into him going into the drugstore there, and he said, he asked me, how are you doing? And I said to him, I feel like S-H-I-T. And the look on his face was that wasn't what he was expecting. And then I got away, then I went to church the following Sunday. I asked Roy Hamley, who's a counselor of sorts. I said, Roy, this is what happened to me the other day, and you know I shouldn't have said that, but what should I have said? He said, well, Steve, he said, people ask that question because they don't know what to say.
Right.
And I said, well, what should I have said? He said, perhaps you should have said something like, some days are better than others. And if they really want to know more, they will ask. But really what they're trying to do is get past that awkward moment as well. And that was always helpful. Then one other, because Sue died on June 13th. And I do a morning quiet time every morning, nearly every morning. For a long time. And that includes a gratitude list. And number 3 on my gratitude list for the morning she died, I left the house at 5:15 that morning. And an hour before that, I had written down number 3 on my gratitude list was how attractive I thought she was. That she had just turned 62, and she was much older. And she had just turned 62, and I thought, isn't it cool that I find her more physically attractive at 62 than I did at 22. Oh, another thing, so my cousin gave me this book a long time ago. He said, this is not exactly helpful, but it is helpful, is up until 50, your body is aging, and after 50, your body is decaying.
That's a different way of looking at it.
I want to check in with Paulette. How are we doing on time? Do I need to know?
We've got about 5 or 6 minutes.
Okay,
but
so
let me tell you one thing. The day after Bailey died, we were having a family meeting about his funeral, mm-hmm. And I knew they had some strong feelings about the funeral, even though Bailey and I had already planned his funeral. And so about 10 minutes before they were supposed to be there, Pat Ward came walking into my house. And so then she said, I just came by to check on you. And so then they came in and she sat down and she just kind of moved over the sofa and said, here, y'all can sit here. And she took out her piece of paper and started taking notes and calling people and texting Lori about the church and all this stuff. And so we got all of them plans left done. They left and I said, thank you for being here. And she said, I wasn't going to let them bully you.
But Paulette, like that's what our people do.
Yeah.
You know, and they, I think, to bear witness when you're in pain. Yeah, I think Jewish people do it right, sitting Shiva. Bearing witness to someone's pain. Is there anything more sacred? When someone is suffering and heartbroken and the unthinkable has happened. That's our distinctive, right? That's when we have the depth of character and we don't make it about us and we show and we do the thing. And I'm sure you guys have all. My whole life in my 40s is a love letter to my, and for the rest of my life, my whole life is a love letter to my grandmothers. Because they are this great cloud of witnesses that buoy my spirits on the tough days and when I'm sad and when there's grief and I feel helpless and hopeless. Like, I feel like they, my sister texted me this morning because she knew she was praying for different parts of this this presentation. And she said, you know, we come from people who do hard things. And there's something about that, yeah, I do. I come from men and women who love the Lord and who had hard and challenging lives and managed to manifest His light every step of the way. And I want to do that. Like, I don't, of course there's a moment. I've been in the fetal position, and I won't go into details about my divorce today because I'm out of time, but I, like, the loss of that was devastating because it was the loss of a lot of dreams. And so being, but you guys know, you know, even when, you know, Mike's experienced death, Anne's experienced, like, when you experience a severe loss, you know, you don't grieve on the same timeline as other people. And so being patient with other people is a part of the way that we bear witness. But also, you know, just being, trying to be comfortable with other people's discomfort, I think is the biggest gift you can give them. And I wore this outfit. One thing about fours on the Enneagram is they like to, that's the way God made me. I kind of have costumes, right? And so I have this costume today because I feel like the grief I'm carrying today, it's like this black underpart of this dress. I will always carry it. I will love Sean Robichaud till the day I die, and I will love the three kids we created together. So the death of that relationship is not inconsequential to every day of my life. But that doesn't mean that I have to dive in self-pity, drown in it. No, it just means that God gave me a vehicle to be more compassionate and to be more understanding than I would be if those things had never happened to me. So yes, the black underneath is very much the grief I have, but the white overlay hopefully is the light and the hope that I will try to displace. And I can't help but think God needed me to go through these things so that when I teach, that I can be more empathetic. And when I work with my patients, that I have a greater depth of understanding and that no arrogance that I used to have in my 20s before all this. I do, not to be trite about it, but I do think it's been a really powerful, poignant thing for me to experience these losses. And I just want to encourage you to get plugged into all the resources here. And I've got books and, you know, I do think there's hope. And so if you know anybody that's struggling or, you know, I love that we have grief services here. And I just so appreciate you guys letting me talk today. And for you guys being honest and chiming in with your experiences has been amazing. Does anyone have any other thoughts? Have you been sitting back there, Fred?
I'll just share this observation. I wish I had heard this saying much earlier in my life, but it really speaks to how I want my last years to be. I'm going to butcher the quote, but something to the effect that people will forget what you did. They'll never forget how you made them feel. And with that in mind, I'd like to introduce another musical artist into the conversation, in addition to Bob Dylan.
Willie Nelson. And this may speak to some of the other grief I've heard discussed, but I'm not going to do the whole song, but it's Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain. And by the way, I told Vanessa that I want this song played at my funeral. So, you know, if you like Willie, come to my funeral. And I'm not going to sing like Willie. I'm just going to work. But the middle stanza reads, love is like a dying ember.
Yeah.
Only memories remain. And through the ages, I remember blue eyes crying in the rain. Someday when we meet up yonder, we'll stroll hand in hand again. In a land that knows no parting, blue eyes crying.
And I love how that whole album is just like redemption.
Yeah.
You know, this is a story, someone needs a lot of mercy and receives it and grieves. So I really want to thank you. Yes,
Ms. Very quickly, I received a book called What Dying People Want to Hear as I was in a hospice house with a family member. And super helpful. And I understand that it's available very easily through hospice. And I talked about it to some friends who are palliative care nurses at our church in Tampa. And he said to me, how old do you think dying people are? And I said, well, like all ages. He said, physiologically, we're all dying after the age of 27. We're building our bodies, our minds, our synapses to 27. After that, we're dying off, you know, cells and this and that. So he said, please take under consideration that when you read that book, all people want to hear those things now. Don't wait till you think they're dying. Say them now. And so I look through that list and I say those things, or I write them. And I could have never found that on my own.
No, thank you. And here's another book that's been important to me. These are liturgies. This is someone with stage 4 colon cancer that was not had a less than 1% chance of living. And these liturgies help me every morning. So if you're looking for a good liturgy, because sometimes when you're in pain and you're in that anger stage, especially, you need other people to pray for you, or you need more of a real prayer to reach out, which I appreciate. And then I got this, dear friends, it's letters from people dying of cancer. You know, what they said, like this was really precious to me when I have friends that are going through some pain. And I don't know if you guys like to move, but movement is one of our super secret resources. And so really, even getting really in touch with our breath, and eventually I want to get really certified in grief yoga so I can help people move a little bit and really express in their bodies, get through some of that. So if you guys want to pass that on. Daily grief reflection has been important to me, like just this concept of, because sometimes it's not one day at a time. When you're in really acute pain, it's 1 hour at a time. You know, and so having just sort of a plan of action and understanding that it is a process and you will move through it sometimes helps people from getting stuck in that. And then grief recovery has been kind of a cute one, a sweet guide too. All of them have a different flavor, but you guys are all welcome to borrow any of these. And then I've got other more scientific, sciencey books too, for people that have been through the process. And if anyone wants to stay after class, or if anybody wants to process anything they've experienced in this class, or if you think in 2 or 3 days, hey, there's something I want you to think about, or I'm really offended at your music choice. I don't know. But I so appreciate you guys, and I have been so humbled to be here. So thank you so much. I don't want to.
My son Troy, y'all probably, he grew up here, and he has lost so much. He's, he doesn't go to work, hadn't been to work for 3 years. He has Parkinson's, and he's totally lost his speech. And so it's just so hard to go over there and not know what to say and what to do. And but a couple of days ago, I was doing my Bible study, and I thought, And Troy has already told me, Mom, don't ask me about my faith. You know, you just don't know what to say. And so he's like, yes, I do. I've got faith, you know. But anyway, I thought, well, I'm doing this Bible study here at my house. I'm just going to go over to his house.
Yeah.
And so I went over there and I read one of the Psalms. And that's one thing. And anyway, other thing is, I'm starting to talk to him more about what the family's doing.
Yeah.
You know, like, well, Ethan's going to go to a trip, and let me tell you about getting my car worked on, and you know, his motive of answering is to give you a thumbs up, or you know, just that kind of thing. But anyway, yesterday I went over there, just didn't have much time. But I read Psalm 35, and it's a psalm where David is just like, Lord, what's going on? Why don't you answer me? What's going on? And I was so delighted because he said to me, what version is that?
Good.
And the great thing was, I said, look in here, Troy. I said, we gave this to your dad in 1973. And I said, it's from you and Jane and Brian. We didn't call her, I mean, her name was Jane, but we changed it later to her middle name. But, and anyway, then I started telling him about his dad and how that his dad always went to work, but he came home and he focused on the kids. And
yeah.
But anyway, I think it was, maybe we're on to something a little bit.
Yes.
Just to share things that are in the family going on. I don't know. That's one thing about it. You do not know what to say, what to do, how often to go. You know, go when his wife's not there. I mean, you know, there's just a lot of questions you ask yourself. You don't really know what you're doing.
But you showed up.
You showed up. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing. I think I'm
and
seeing
And then he
that.
Knows how much you love him.
Because, you know, they're like, I haven't been open in about 3 weeks. And I was like, you know what, just show up. I told Carrie this morning, I think we just need to show up. Don't figure out how to help him or give him advice.
Right.
He rejects all of that. And so, but just show up. That's all I can do.
Well, Fred's nonverbals tell me it's time. So thank you guys. Thank you so much.
Thank y'all so much. Karen, thank you. You were wonderful.
As I knew you would be.
Have lunch.
That's right. We're going to soon. And Craig Bledsoe will be our speaker next Sunday.